At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When it comes to shopping, a sale is a good thing. A sale on top of a sale is even better. But when there's a sale on top of a sale on top of a sale, it's probably time to worry about the health of the economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcast.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, you're listening to the Marketplace podcast for December 26th. I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdal. For most Americans, today is a day off. But it might not feel like it at malls and shopping centers where the day after Christmas is one of the busiest days of the year. It's when retailers try to put a final jolt into their yearly sales numbers with promotions, coupons, and the deepest of discounts. But this holiday season, which has been nothing but discounts, you have to ask, how low can prices go? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman hit the stores of downtown Portland, Oregon today to find out.
A steady stream of shoppers headed into the Pioneer Place Mall this morning. Megan Ward headed back out just after 9 a.m. with shopping bags full.
We did some returns and then bought clothes that I wanted instead or fit better. And then I got more outfits.
She was able to buy more because of the deep discounts stores are running this week to try to zero out their Christmas inventory at any price. Retail analyst Patty Edwards says these sales tell a tale of retailers that were too optimistic when they put their orders in earlier this year.
There are places in retail land that have way too much inventory. And I think you can really tell just by the percentage off that you're seeing. So Abercrombie & Fitch offering 50% off everything in the store. But if you look at Nordstrom or you look at Macy's, it's select discounts on select items.
Edwards says hip fashion chains in particular had a tough Christmas. Could be because unemployment's so high among young adults. But isn't holiday shopping all about giving to others? NPD retail analyst Marshall Cohen says not really. This season it was all about self-gifting.
We see electronics getting a boost from the self-gifting. You don't give many TVs as a gift, but you certainly buy them for yourself.
Shoppers like Ashley McMullen, though, are seeking something else as they brave the post-Christmas crowds.
Compared to the craziness of being with family, it's kind of a nice mindless break.
Call it family retail therapy. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Over the weekend, the hacker group known as Anonymous launched a Christmas attack. The group has already taken responsibility for attacks on music industry websites and government agencies, and it announced this weekend via Twitter that it had stolen thousands of credit card numbers from the client lists of a company in Texas. Anonymous said it planned to use those stolen credit cards to donate $1 million to charity. But then came a retraction. Anonymous says it wasn't us. Marketplace's Gregory Warner reports.
The retraction was posted sometime last night. The collective hacker group Anonymous denied responsibility for the attack. It blamed rogue hackers for misusing the name Anonymous, which is a tricky problem when the name of your group is Anonymous.
Anyone can do an operation in the name of Anonymous, and several have, and therefore it becomes difficult to have brand control and brand management.
Joshua Corman is director of security intelligence for Akamai Technologies. He blogs about Anonymous. He says the group is aiming for legitimacy as a political movement. It says it doesn't attack media sources. The company that got hacked, called Stratfor, publishes a daily newsletter on global security issues. Corman says another possibility, less likely, is that Anonymous did do it, then realized whose credit cards and passwords they stole.
They didn't realize how powerful some of the subscribers to Stratfor are. and got very scared of the blowback and are now pretending they didn't do it.
Stratfor has military and law enforcement subscribers around the world. Anonymous members voted via Twitter which charities would receive donations from the stolen credit cards. The list included a children's hospice, the ACLU, and a charity supporting small businesses in Haiti and Guatemala. Peter Haas is executive director of that charity called AIDG.
We are probably the smallest one on the list, so getting on the list was a big deal for us.
Haas tweeted Anonymous this morning begging not to donate with stolen credit cards. He'll just have to give the money back and pay a surcharge of $35. Robinhood doesn't work when there's a cyber trail. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Wall Street was closed for Christmas, but markets in Asia were moving. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The latest news on the European debt crisis is brought to you by the letters GRD. That's the code banks use for the old Greek currency, the drachma. And according to the Wall Street Journal, some global banks are trying to figure out how they'll get their computers to recognize that code again if the euro breaks up and the Greeks go back to the drachma. The idea of a eurozone collapse is raising red flags with international banks because it could bring another global financial crisis, even perhaps a global recession. Here to talk about that with us is Simon Johnson. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Simon Johnson, welcome to Marketplace.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Let me ask you first, when we hear about a recession these days, it seems like we're talking more and more about a global recession. So when was the last non-global recession that we had?
Well, that's a good question. If you look at Asia in the late 1990s, they had a big slowdown, a series of crises, really, and the rest of the world kept going fairly strong. Other places, including Argentina and Brazil, had crises and big slowdowns at the beginning of the 2000s, and the world was pretty strong. We haven't seen, though, a really serious slowdown in the United States that doesn't spill over to the rest of the world for quite some time. The U.S. is so central to the way the world's trade works and increasingly to the way the world's financial system works that I think it's all global from here on in.
It's all global from here on out. So if we are about to go into another recession, it's going to be a global recession just because we're so intertwined with everybody else?
Yes. The key dimension of intertwining in this respect is the financial intertwining. If you have a Lehman-type panic, that spreads around the world very, very quickly. If you can imagine a U.S. recession without those kinds of financial spillovers, perhaps the effects on other countries would be limited. But I think for 2012, what we're looking at most likely is a crisis with the epicenter in Europe around sovereign debt and around the European banks. That would then spread to us through our banking linkages and also around the world, either through tightening credit or runs of various kinds away from major financial players. That combination is almost certainly going to be toxic for everyone.
Well, what's the reason for this? Why should every recession be a global recession? Is this simply because our banks have gotten too big or what?
Yes, the banks have become very big. They've become very global. They've enmeshed themselves in non-transparent ways, ways that perhaps they don't understand, and certainly the regulators don't understand. And that means that a relatively small shock or fear about a shock can lead to consequences far away in the United States or perhaps even in China or in Africa. I don't think anyone in the world is immune from these kinds of modern financial shocks.
And is this something that you as an international economist look at and say, it's too bad we made such mistakes and now we're in this situation? Or do you say this was inevitable? Globalization, global trade, global banking, this had to happen.
I don't think it had to happen in exactly this form. Part of the problem is we've allowed a lot of moral hazard to build up in the system, meaning people feel that they're going to be protected on the downside so they can't lose their deposits, they can't lose the money they've lent to Goldman Sachs or whatever the big international player. So what happens when there is a big slowdown, when there are major losses, when somebody actually fails, there's a big repricing of risk. That fear spreads widely across an asset class, and people move together in the modern financial world much more than they did in the past.
Well, what do we do to deal with this new reality of every recession being a global recession? How do you prepare for it?
Well, I think you need firewalls. People talk about this a lot, but it's like the weather. They talk about it, but nobody does actually,
right.
actually does anything about it. Firewalls means you should have systems so that if a big French bank or a big German bank goes down, we need to be immune in the United States from the major shock waves. You can't be completely immune. That would be an illusion. But you have to wall yourself off much more. You have to break those linkages. The transactions in markets have to become much more transparent. We're interconnected. Big bad things can happen in faraway places, and nobody is ready for what will come next.
Simon Johnson is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, also a professor at MIT's Sloan School of Management. Simon Johnson, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Once you get past the big family dinner and the tree and the music and the general good faith and feeling that Christmas brings, it is also a holiday about presents and material things, which means your economic well-being can be directly tied to your mood. To get a sense of how that played itself out this year, we asked two families from two different economic backgrounds to tell us. First, to Iowa City, Iowa.
I'm Bob Walker.
And I'm Christy Walker, and we're in Iowa City, Iowa.
I am a department chair at Mount Mercy University and teach business classes in our undergrad and graduate programs.
And I'm the director of clinical applications for the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. So for Christmas, usually we will travel every year. This year, we spent Christmas at home with our family.
You know, we got up and we ate and then opened gifts.
Always encourage them to make gifts. We help the grandchildren make birdhouses. My daughter came over and cleaned out our laundry room and reorganized it for us. And that was the best gift of all.
We've already booked our reservations for next year.
We decided that it was much more stressful and not nearly as joyful staying at home and buying gifts. So we decided as family we're going to make sure that we keep it a priority to get away at Christmas time.
We're going to Disney World. So.
Sounds fun. Now let's check in with another family in Galesville, Wisconsin.
I'm Paul Kinzer.
And I'm Winna Mortensen, and we have a 10-year-old son. His name is Bjorn, and we live in Galesville, Wisconsin.
I work in the school-age child care program.
And I am the youth services librarian at the Galesville Public Library.
We both work part-time, and our jobs provide very little in the way of benefits.
What I like to do is I watch all year long with Christmas in mind, and I have many times purchased gifts at rummage sales or at thrift stores. On Christmas Day, we spent the whole day with my family, my parents, and my sister's family and my two brothers' families. We had a fantastic brunch with Swedish sausage, is what we have every year, and lots of Christmas cookies that I brought along, and we opened our presents and had the Yuletide entertainment.
It's something we've only been doing for a little while, and we call it the Yuletide entertainment, where when we get together with Winna's family, people are not forced, but
encouraged
to do some little thing, a skit, a magic show, and our son, he really, really gets into that.
Yeah, everybody just sits around grinning, and then our faces really hurt at the end.
Two holiday experiences, both of which came to us from our Public Insight Network. Coming up, the year in which Congress agrees to disagree.
They went right up to the day when the Treasury Department said it could no longer legally pay the government's bills. Ultimately, it was resolved with the creation of that super committee, and we all know how that went.
Oh, yes, we do. But first, let's do the numbers. Stock markets in the U.S. and Europe were closed for the Christmas holiday. They'll reopen tomorrow. Asian markets were open today and the trading was light. In Japan, the Nikkei was up 1%. And in China, the Shanghai Composite shed 0.7%. Today, Japan and China reached an agreement to allow a direct exchange of their currencies so businesses from their countries can do deals together without first converting to U.S. dollars. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. The Conference Board releases the Consumer Confidence Index for December. We'll also get the Case-Shiller Index, which shows real estate data for the top 20 housing markets in the country. And it's the 10th anniversary of permanent normal trade relations between China and the U.S. Thanks for all the cheap stuff, guys. I'm Desiree Pena.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdal. And I'm happy to announce that if you see a countdown clock somewhere this week, it is probably counting down to the end of 2011, not to the moment at which the federal government shuts down if Congress can't agree to reach a deal to fund it. Nice change, right? 2011 has been a year of tense standoffs in Washington that usually boiled down to two parties that just couldn't see eye to eye on spending and taxes. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has been covering it all for us this year, and he's here now to give us the highlights and the lowlights. Hi, John.
Hello, Jeremy.
So it's been a year of stalemate and brinksmanship in Washington leading right up to last week when we had the last second extension of the payroll tax cut. In all of your years covering Washington, have you ever seen anything like this?
Never like this. Never with so many cliffhangers. Topping them all was the debt ceiling impasse.
Right.
The August deadline over increasing the government's authority to borrow. That came the closest to shutting down the government. They went right up to the day when the Treasury Department said it could no longer legally pay the government's bills. Ultimately, it was resolved with the creation of that super committee, and we all know how that went.
Indeed, we do. And also, of course, the nation's credit rating was downgraded as a result of all the debt ceiling trouble. John, what were the legislative consequences of all of this back and forth that never seemed to lead anywhere in Washington?
All sorts of proposals to use government policy to help the economy. We're talking aid to states to keep teachers and police employed, or infrastructure projects to rebuild roads and schools, or safety net payments for long-term unemployed. Gridlock just defeated all of them. Good or a bad thing, depending on your view of the effectiveness of government policies. But there were continuing stalemates over a national energy strategy or an immigration plan. Judicial nominees were held up. Some of the openings on regulatory agencies, like that new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau,
right,
or the National Labor Relations Board. There are all sorts of vacancies.
Well, just to give Washington a fair shake here, were there any things that did get through in 2011?
Well, summer debt ceiling deal didn't work with Plan A, the super committee, but Plan B required across-the-board cuts of more than $1 trillion. It's not going to happen until 2013, of course, and there's already talk that those cuts might be rescinded, but they're in place right now, and that's a big step toward getting the government's deficits under control. If you go to the White House website and you look up legislative accomplishments for 2011, it's a pretty meager list. There's free trade deals with three countries and patent reform to give inventors more incentives, but that's about it.
And is this what we're to expect in 2012, John?
Absolutely. You know, we're going to be in the middle of an election, a very polarizing election, which keeps most bills from passing Congress anyway. But it's going to give voters a very clear choice between different visions of the government's role in the economy.
Well, John, I want to ask you one more thing when it comes to the economy, which is that Washington's economy is really pretty different than the economy in the rest of the country. Because the federal government is there, the jobless rate is lower than in a lot of places. The housing market is a lot better than it is in a lot of places. Do you think that lawmakers in Washington understand the depths of this economic downturn?
I think the lawmakers do, because they hear from their constituents loud and clear. But the lawmakers also hear a message from lobbyists. Mm. They're a well-heeled group, and their message frequently it runs counter to what the voters are clamoring for. And lawmakers rely on those lobbyists for campaign cash, for information in their arguments. I think that's where a lot of the disconnect lies.
Marketplace Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale. John, thanks so much and Happy New Year.
Thanks, Jeremy. Same to you.
When you hear the term Silicon Valley, what do you think of? A really futuristic oasis where geniuses ride down the streets on their Segway scooters? A place where every other storefront is an internet startup with the potential to change the way we live? Well, in fact, what we think of as Silicon Valley isn't really a valley at all. The tech community extends from San Francisco south towards San Jose. There are wealthy venture capitalists living in the hills, families living in garden spots like Palo Alto, and of course, some people who are getting left behind. Marketplace's Steve Henn takes us on an economic tour of Silicon Valley.
Early this fall, Sean Parker threw a party. You may remember Parker. As a kid, he helped create Napster. He was the bad boy in the movie The Social Network. His stake in Facebook made him a billionaire. The party was for Spotify, a streaming music company he has a piece of. And it was pretty fabulous. There were whole roast pigs turning on spits, the indie band the Killers played, and Parker chartered jets from L.A. and New York to bring in the beautiful people. By the middle of the night, Snoop Dogg was hanging with Facebook founder and boy billionaire Mark Zuckerberg. The wealth being created in Silicon Valley these days can be mind-blowing. And for the programmers and engineers who keep this money machine running, the recovery is well underway.
Just from here to San Francisco, there's four billboards saying we're hiring. So Groupon, Twitter, Facebook, Zynga, everybody's fighting for talent.
Gary Swart is CEO of Odesk. He helps tech firms hire employees from all over the world. They work remotely. It's one way to avoid the bidding wars for software programmers. Rodham Perlmutter runs a recruiting website called Top Prospect. He says the market for tech talent is tight.
I think it's never been tighter. I was here in the late 90s, and it was hard to find people then, and I'd say it's at least as hard today.
His site will pay a finder's fee of up to $20,000 if you recommend a Facebook friend who lands a job Perlmutter's trying to fill. In just 2 days this fall, he cut five checks and sent out tens of thousands of dollars. So for the objects of the tech industry's affection, life on the leafy streets of Palo Alto has never been better. But for non-techies, not so much.
My name is Claudia Warren. I am a mom of two girls that are college age.
Claudia and her family live in a little town called Millbrae. Like many towns here, it's expensive. Nice homes, good schools. Claudia and her husband stretched to afford it, and now they're in trouble.
I've been unemployed for a year and a month. And the business that I worked in prior, I was there for 15 and a half years. 15 and a half years, that's a long time to be somewhere.
Claudia was a buyer at a baby store that went under. Her husband has a good job, but her paycheck mattered, and with no college degree, she can't find work.
Scary. Money ran out. It's tough.
Warren's daughter quit her traveling softball team to save money, and she's joining the Army Reserves to pay for college. And there are lots of families like the Warrens here. People living in the shadow of a job boom they're not part of. The unemployment rate in the heart of Silicon Valley was higher than the national average for most of this recession. Even in the wealthiest enclaves, some families are quietly struggling. I know middle-aged engineers in Palo Alto, guys with impressive degrees who've been looking for work for 2 years. But young companies like engineers with the latest skills. And just across a little bridge from Palo Alto, on the other side of Highway 101, things are much worse. The border of East Palo Alto is probably less than a mile from Mark Zuckerberg's house. But it is a different world. There are fewer trees. Empty lots are strung with razor wire. Officially, the unemployment rate is 20%. Carlos Romero is the mayor.
We do provide a lot of service sector workers to Silicon Valley, whether it's in the hotels, whether it's domestics, whether it's folks working in the restaurants, whether it's the construction industry. And all of those areas took a downturn.
Romero says when the recession hit, his city was still reeling from the last downturn, which destroyed thousands of good blue-collar jobs. The city built big box stores and a fancy hotel for tech executives to try and fill the gap. It helped, but it wasn't enough.
A lot of the manufacturing has moved out. And so folks who were from East Palo Alto who might be able to kind of meet the educational requirements for those manufacturing jobs no longer have the ability to get into those jobs because they don't exist.
The jobs being created in Silicon Valley, thousands of them, are mostly in high tech. But many guys from here, like Marquis Solomon, can't get them.
The people that actually end up in those types of jobs, wow, that's, I've never really just seen them walk in the street. They're not the people that you see. The people that you see are the people that are unemployed.
Solomon's been out of work for 4 years. He lives in a depressed section of East Menlo Park, just around the corner from where Facebook's building its new headquarters. But that probably won't help him.
I mean, this is really a knowledge-based society at this point. And really, a big part of our problem is dealing with folks who have, you know, we have probably a 30, possibly 35% dropout rate in high schools.
And here's the thing. Some of the best public schools in California, some of the most lavishly funded public schools in the nation, are located just a few miles from here.
I don't know anywhere in the country where there's this stark of a change between sort of the haves and the have-nots.
Peter Fortenbaugh is president of the local Boys and Girls Club.
So basically, the kids who need the most, who are the most behind, get the least resources. And it just continues to get more extreme in our community.
Fortenbaugh says most of these kids simply are not being prepared for the kinds of jobs Silicon Valley is creating. And in a globally competitive market, unless something changes, he says, they probably don't stand a chance. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, as we get ready for a week of year-in-review stuff, if you think of the biggest, most impactful global news events of the year, you'd have to include the earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster in Japan, the Arab Spring and all the dictators who are no longer in power, and of course, the European debt crisis. Which brings us to the United States, a country that wasn't at the center of any major crises this year. Yes, we lost our AAA credit rating, but the consequences of that have so far been negligible. So as we close out 2011, take a breather. It wasn't all about us this year. And given all that happened, that's probably a good thing. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. U.S. markets were closed today. Our producers include Avishai Artsy, Gina Delvac, Millie Jefferson, and Fiona Ng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time, back on this show, we all know drunk driving is dangerous, but drunk walking?
Walking drunk is one of the most dangerous activities you can engage in.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.